Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. This morning, I drank a cup of tea, I ate breakfast, I talked to my family, I brushed my teeth, and I kissed everybody goodbye. What's involved in all of these activities? My mouth, which plays a starring role not just in my mornings, but all day, every day. Think about it. We need it to talk, to eat, to drink, to breathe. And that importance is reflected in medicine.
To me, the mouth is like the real, true gateway to the soul. I think of it as this prime real estate in your body. And so every biologic system that you have kind of puts up this flagship store there.
That's Pulse contributor Avir Mitra. He's in New York completing his residency in emergency medicine.
You know, you have the digestive system starting there with teeth and saliva to start digesting food. You have this incredible flagship outlet for the nervous system, which puts these really unique chemical sensors in your tongue that give us what we call taste. And, you know, the immune system long ago recognized that we keep getting infected from our mouths. So they set up these huge surveillance towers in the back of your mouth called the tonsils. And of course, there's communication that starts at the vocal cords and utilizes all these like small muscle movements of the mouth. So there's so much going on in the mouth. And therefore, you know, when it comes to modern healthcare, it's also way more than just dentistry or way more than any one specialty.
Over the course of your life, you could have dentists, endodontists, periodontists, oral surgeons, ear, nose, and throat doctors, neurosurgeons, pediatricians, or primary care doctors all poking around in your mouth. As an ER doctor, Avir says the mouth can be a really useful diagnostic tool for a patient with unusual symptoms. For example, he realized recently that a patient likely was HIV positive because this woman had thrush on her tongue. That's a rash that usually only affects babies.
Or like, you know, nowadays we have to worry a little bit more about measles. And when you one way to find that is to look under the tongue, on the bottom, kind of just in the mucus part under the tongue. If you see these little white spots, they're called Koplik spots. That's like a harbinger that you have measles. You probably haven't had any symptoms yet, but you're infected. So there's also just like old school primary care. They used to use the tongue a lot. Like the old school doctors, they could look at your tongue and tell if you're anemic or tell if you have jaundice or if you're lacking in vitamin B12, for example, your tongue becomes kind of beefy. So it's just a huge world in there.
So when I go in for a general checkup and my doctor says, you know, stick out your tongue and I go, bleh, they are really looking for stuff in there. That's not just, it's not just a ritual,
yeah.
Right?
Right. There's so many things. And some of it's becoming like a lost art too, because nowadays we have lab values and x-rays and CT scans. But back in the day, you know, doctors just would look at your mouth and get so much information about your overall health just from looking there.
So on today's show, we're going to explore this prime real estate that is our mouth. We'll visit a dentist's office to talk about pain management and opioids. We'll explore the ancient history of mouth decor, and we'll check out the hundreds of razor-sharp teeth in a shark's mouth. But let's start with this. Avir was just talking about how so many different medical specialties claim portions of the mouth, and our first story is an example of this. When babies' tongues are tied to the floor of their mouths with a tight band of tissue, it's called a tongue tie, it's often diagnosed by a midwife. Then a pediatrician will weigh in, and a lot of times that tongue tie is snipped by a pediatric dentist. And joining me now to talk more about this is Pulse reporter Tanya English. Hi, Tanya.
Hey, Mike.
And Tanya, you actually attended a snipping of a tongue tie.
Yes, I was right there. Brace yourself. It's a little hard to listen to.
Mm. Okay.
Let's see that tongue. Giving us a good look at that tongue tie.
Ear, nose, and throat surgeon Heather Nardone has one gloved finger knuckle deep in Maxwell's mouth.
This is Maxwell. His middle name is Leo, and he has two last names, too. His last name is Kessler Reza.
Maxwell is 2 weeks old and not yet 7 pounds. His mom, Esmeralda Reza Vasquez, says from day one, it was hard for Maxwell to nurse. He'd get tired after just 3 or 4 minutes.
Everyone was saying he was really skinny, so then I said we should try a breast pump because my breasts were still really swollen.
Maxwell wasn't gaining weight, so his pediatrician sent him to see a specialist at Nemours Hospital for Children in Wilmington, Delaware.
And Mom, why don't you come over so you can see too? All right, Maxwell. So I'm looking at that little piece of tissue there. You see that little cord of tissue?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the tongue tie. And what it's doing is tethering the bottom of the tongue to the floor of his mouth. Okay?
Reza Vasquez and her mom are a tag team, taking turns quieting the baby. Grandmom is a high-strung fast talker. Her daughter is soft-spoken and skittish about what she knows is coming next for Maxwell. Nardone takes out surgical scissors to snip the cord beneath his tongue.
So, Linda's going to help me to open Maxwell's mouth, and then I am just isolating that frenulum under the tongue and using the incision to cut back until we reach the muscle of the tongue. Good, and that's it. A gauze. Put a little pressure on that to stop the small amount of bleeding that there is. And then we'll take one more look and make sure we're happy with the sight. And that looks perfect, so we're all done.
The procedure happened right there in the office, and it's over in less than 45 seconds. Afterward, the doctor dips her finger in sugar water, and Maxwell sucks and calms down quickly. Maxwell had what is commonly known as a tongue tie, meaning the membrane under his tongue, his frenulum, was short and connected all the way to the tip of the tongue.
The medical term is ankyloglossia. In Maxwell's case, I would say he has a severe ankyloglossia.
Because of this, Maxwell couldn't lift his tongue very high or stick it out. Most importantly, he couldn't latch well onto his mother's breast when it was time to eat. Many babies with a tongue tie don't need any kind of procedure, but Maxwell's mom wanted to breastfeed almost exclusively. So the ear, nose, and throat specialist, Heather Nardone, recommended that they release his tongue to improve its motion. An hour north at a busy practice in Philadelphia, pediatric dentist Paul Bond does the frenulum procedure, and he evaluates babies with a possible tongue tie problem.
The tongue has to go out and grab the nipple and, you know, pull it into the mouth. Now, the next big piece is the tongue almost makes this wave, this peristaltic wave motion. So the tongue actually has to almost strip milk from the nipple.
And that's how nursing works. But getting milk from a bottle takes a little less work because there's a built-in protruding nipple and holes at the tip for easy flow. Lots of children with a mild or moderate tongue tie eat from a bottle just fine. But breastfeeding is pretty popular these days. Back in the 1990s, only about 55% of U.S. moms attempted breastfeeding. Today, federal health surveys show that 80% of mothers at least try to nurse. Paul Bond says that increased interest in nursing spotlights a difference in the structure of the mouth that often goes unnoticed unless there's a problem.
So you can hear a small little fan that runs.
Business is so good now that dentist Paul Bond now leads a standalone company called Infant Laser Dentistry. It's separate from his pediatric practice, and he can do as many as 5 frenulum snip procedures a day. To cut the tissue under the tongue, instead of surgical scissors, Bond uses a medical laser.
It's not shooting across the room. It's not dangerous. The folks in the room and the babies all have protective eyewear on.
The laser might not be what you're imagining.
Because, you know, when you say laser to me, I'm thinking Star Trek.
It's a light beam that comes out of here where it's just a beep, and it produces heat at the very tip of that, and that interacts with the tissue in a focalized spot.
The laser is the size of an electric toothbrush, and it's designed to cauterize the wound as it cuts.
The assistant that's with me is using a suction, and that's right next to the baby's mouth, so it sucks all that, you know, debris, junk, any plume that comes out of that area, right into our suction system.
Bond says the mouth heals quickly, and the risk of infection is very low. In surveys of physicians and lactation consultants, there's disagreement about when and if a tongue tie should be divided to help with breastfeeding.
For as best we could probably study these things, there's evidence out there that it does help.
I met one of Dr. Bond's patients, 6-month-old Ellis, at his home with his mom. Ellis is a good eater today, but his mom, Catherine Gajewski, says at first, pain during nursing was a big problem.
I would say day one, latch one. Pretty immediately it started to hurt.
Ellis seemed like he was chomping instead of teasing out her milk.
Gosh, it just feels like this beautiful tiny being is rubbing your nipple raw.
Ellis is a sturdy climber with ruddy cheeks and a fuzz of brown hair. Strangers, microphone cords, nothing fazes that kid. Early on, Gajewski had lots of help. She had a doula, her midwife, and frequent visits from a lactation consultant. And still, she and Ellis struggled with breastfeeding.
I had all of, you know, these notions in my head about supplementing with formula and kind of equated that with failure and everything else.
Those first few weeks were stressful, and Ellis was fussy. Looking back, Gajewski is convinced that Ellis was just really hungry. She gave him a bottle, but worried her milk supply would slow, that Ellis would become a lazy feeder.
So another concern when you're working through all of this and trying to get to successful breastfeeding is that your baby might start to prefer the bottle over the breast and that you can never kind of get them back to the boob.
When Ellis was 3.5 weeks old, he had the laser procedure to untether his tongue. The doctor prescribed some post-op exercises. Gajewski had to roll her finger around in Ellis's mouth to break up the scar tissue. And she says that was the worst part. The wound was still fresh, it was uncomfortable for Ellis, and unnerving for her. After that, the baby had to relearn how to use his tongue.
It would kind of flop around for those first few weeks after the laser treatment. And then he figured it out, and about 3 weeks after the treatment, things clicked and we were off to the races.
It's not clear that the tongue snip was the fix, but today nursing Ellis is pain-free. The consultation with the pediatric dentist plus the procedure cost about $450. Gajewski paid out of pocket and then tried to get Ellis's dental insurance to pay up. That claim was rejected, but she's resubmitting and hopes Ellis's medical insurance will pick up the bill.
All right, Tanya, really interesting story. I have a couple of questions. Do all babies with this kind of issue get their tongue tie snipped?
No, not at all. There's a pretty wide spectrum of connectedness to the floor of the mouth. There's thick tongue ties, short ones, some that are tethered at the back, the front, all different positions under the tongue. No one I spoke with recommends that the tie be clipped just routinely. There needs to be a documented problem, and there needs to be a reason to suspect that the tongue tie is the problem.
And what does research say about the effectiveness of this?
You know, when the American Academy of Pediatrics looked into this, there wasn't a lot of evidence on it. There was one study that did some sham procedures with one group of babies and then gave the real frenulum procedure to the other group of babies. And it was only the babies that got the real snip that improved breastfeeding. So that tells us something. It's important to note, though, that babies have trouble feeding for all sorts of different reasons. And sometimes at the beginning of life, they're slow to gain weight. So you really just have to check with your doctor or consult a lactation consultant to figure out what's going on.
All right. One more question. What about the poor little baby we heard crying so hard at the beginning of the piece?
Yeah, that was baby Maxwell. He's doing well now. A couple weeks after his little procedure, he's nursing well. And his mom says she's pain-free, too.
All right, great. Thank you, Tanya.
Thank you.
Our show today is about the mouth. And saying that, I'm thinking about teeth. And then I start thinking about the dentist and dental pain. I've had a lot of terrible dental pain in my life. And I have to say, that kind of pain is intense. I've given birth to 2 children, and dental pain was worse. So dentists are in a tough spot. They have to address serious, intense pain in their patients. And the nation is in the middle of a major drug epidemic fueled in part by prescription painkillers. So dentists are now looking for new approaches, and they're coming up with some surprisingly simple solutions. Here's Pulse reporter Alana Gordon.
Firsts can be life-changing. Think about your first kiss, your first time behind the wheel of a car. But what about the first time you got a prescription for a narcotic? It's not hard to find this answer, wandering around the college area of West Philadelphia.
I had Vicodin for my wisdom teeth, and I know I got 5 teeth taken out, so they gave me that, yeah.
When I got my wisdom teeth out 2 years ago,
I got my wisdom teeth taken out in August, and I was prescribed Percocet a lot.
What do you mean a lot?
Like 20 pills.
This really shouldn't come as a surprise. Each year, some 3.5 million young adults get their wisdom teeth out. James Hatzell didn't realize it at the time, but it was a pivotal moment for him.
I was very excited to get my wisdom teeth out.
Wait, what?
Yes.
Hatzell distinctly remembers that spring day, his junior year of high school in South Jersey. He was en route with mom to what one would typically imagine to be a very, very terrible thing. But again,
we're in our 2001 Honda Odyssey minivan, you know, driving to the dentist, and we get there, and I'm just like pumped.
This was almost 7 years ago. Hatzell was 17, and he knew that after the dentist cut out his molars, not only would he get to sit around and eat ice cream, he'd get his very own bottle of pain pills.
So I'm like, all right, let's do this thing. And they hook me up to the morphine drip, and they say count backwards from 10. And I started counting backwards.
Up till then, pills seemed kind of scary to Hatzell. He'd actually tried Vicodin before, somewhat cautiously. Friends of his would find an extra pill in a medicine cabinet at home. They'd crush it, mix it with pot, and share it. This was different. For the first time, a health professional was going to say, here, this is okay to take. In fact, it will help you. On the way home, Hatzell was still high from the drugs given during the procedure, but he could not wait to pop that first pill. His mom noticed.
You know, she's like sort of like looking at me a little bit concerned on how much I'm enjoying this.
He turned up a certain Pink Floyd song.
And I'm like sitting there in the car with my mouth full of cotton balls and gauze. There's like blood coming out, right? Because I'd just gotten surgery and that's what happens. Just like totally into it, loving it. And we got home and my mom took the pills and was like, you can't have these.
So that was it?
Well, no, that was not it.
Hatzell was livid. The dentist had prescribed those pain pills to him. But being the trickster kid that he was, he knew exactly where that bottle was hidden. Mom's jewelry drawer. He had a plan for not getting caught.
So I empty all the pills out.
He emptied out the pills and replaced them with Advil. Mom had no idea.
I'm just like, you know, I start taking them.
You're like every parent's worst nightmare.
Yes. I definitely was every parent's worst nightmare.
Hatzell says he can joke about this now, but nothing about what happened to him or his family was funny then. That prescription would mark the start of a downward spiral, one that would include being arrested for dealing drugs in college. He nearly lost everything. Up until that point, he'd only dabbled with pills.
I had never had a large quantity of them that I could just take as much as I wanted. And it was sort of like a defining moment in my addiction or my downfall where I thought that that became okay.
Dentists have been frequent prescribers of opioids like Vicodin and Percocet to address acute short-term pain. But it's often tough to figure out when these strong, potentially addictive pain meds are appropriate.
You're going to use this hand piece to remove the bone that's on top of it.
One person on the front lines of this is Dr. Joel Funeri. He extracts wisdom teeth on a regular basis in his oral surgery practice in Devon, Pennsylvania. So get ready, because he's about to drill into a college-age guy's impacted wisdom tooth to remove it. When he started as a dentist, Funeri says it was not that unusual for people in his field to prescribe a bottle of 30 or more strong narcotics to someone after taking out their wisdom teeth.
Dentists don't like to see patients in pain. They want to get them out of pain. You know, we tend to be compassionate people, and I think we were falling into a trap that we were creating ourselves.
A trap of excessive prescribing. Dr. Funeri is part of a group that's been trying to address this. It's developed state guidelines for dentists on opioid prescribing. And looking at the research, he realized something he had long suspected.
That the Motrins, the Advils, the Aleves, when used in a certain way, were very effective, more effective than the narcotics.
Because wisdom teeth removal is done so often, it's actually been an ideal procedure to study the benefits of this approach. But
that has not filtered down to the level of the general dentist or even the smaller practices and some of the subspecialties. And that's basically where we're going now.
The guidelines are the state's first on prescribing narcotics for dental patients. Other states and the National Dental Association are moving in the same direction. There's also an effort to work on additional education for patients and require training for dentists. But one challenge is countering long-held perceptions.
The opioids have a lot of hype.
Elliot Hirsch is a professor of pharmacology and oral surgery at the University of Pennsylvania and is a leading researcher on postoperative dental pain. He says anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen,
they don't have as much hype. Why? Because they're available over the counter. And what a lot of the lay public believe is that if they're available over the counter, they're weak and they don't work.
He takes a hardline approach in the classroom with future dentists.
I've been teaching my students that you have to be really, really careful with these drugs, that if you write too many of these drugs for either good intentions or bad intentions, either the state dental board and or the DEA is going to come down on you.
But even so, none of this is an exact science. Every patient's response to pain is unique. Hirsch has found that around 20% of patients still need a combination of both anti-inflammatory medication and narcotics to control it. But here's the problem.
The patients are still numb when we prescribe. So we don't know who that 20% is going to be that also requires an opioid added on.
A doctor may have a sense of what's to come, depending on what happened during surgery. But why some patients feel more pain than others is still a mystery. And it all means that dentists may end up writing a prescription for at least some opioids to be on the safe side.
You know, they use one or two, and then there's eight left over.
And these leftover drugs can be part of the problem. It was for James Hatzell. He's been in recovery for 3 years now. And along the way, he's seen other peers take a darker turn.
What it's like graduating high school in the 2000s or the 2010s is your classmates die. They overdose on drugs and they die. You'll see in the obituary, died suddenly, died in their sleep. Or, you know, there'll be some courageous families who will actually publicly state that they died of an overdose.
So for him, one of the most terrifying thoughts as he navigates his own addiction is that one day he might need surgery, that his ACL might rip, or that he'll develop a bad tooth infection. But it's not the actual rip or the procedure itself that frightens him. It's the drugs.
Because I don't want to take any at all. But, you know, I might be put in a situation where it's medically appropriate for me, and I don't want to have to make that decision.
Nowadays, Hatzell makes it a point whenever he goes to the dentist to say right up front that he cannot take narcotics. Pennsylvania and New Jersey have databases now that will show dentists a patient's prescription history. There's a push for a national database. But the next step is how dentists will use that information. That's something they're still working on. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
We just heard from Jimmy Hatzell, his story of addiction and recovery, and he mentioned his mom in his story. And that got me thinking, what is she saying about all of this and how he deceived her? So let's give her a call.
Hello?
Hi, is this Jimmy's mom?
Yes.
Hi.
Yes, this is Jimmy's mom.
Hi, Sylvia, right?
Yes.
So, Sylvia, Jimmy told this story about the pills he got from the dentist when he got his wisdom teeth out.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentioned that he was perhaps too excited about getting those pills, and you took them from him, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you have any idea he got them anyway? He switched them out?
No, I did not. I think he just told me this, like, you know, when he came back from talking to you.
Right.
Were
you mad?
I laughed. I was like, oh, my God. I mean, I would, like, if it was 3 years ago or, you know, I would not have thought that was funny.
What are some things you've learned going through all of this?
Well, I guess it's changed us as a family. When you have a child like this, you know, we were kind of suspicious in high school, but you don't know if it's immaturity or if it's a phase or, you know, if he's just going to grow out of it. You just don't know. Like, you don't want to believe that it's a problem because you think you don't want that for them. But you know, when his life came crashing down a couple years later, you know, it was a very isolating experience. It was really hard. It was hard.
Yeah.
Like, people don't know how to respond to you, you know what I mean? Because they know something happened, but it's not like, you know, they bring you casseroles because, you know, your child has cancer. It's, oh, you know, he's got a problem. And they don't know how to react to you. So you hide, really, you know?
How has this experience affected you and your life, your career, what you do?
Well, we became activist parents. So, like, you just want to hear one person, just one person tell you that it's possible that it's going to be okay. And so that's what I do. So I started doing that, and I really like doing that because I love giving people a message of hope because there is, you know, there's a lot of hope. I mean, recovery, everybody talks about addiction. Nobody talks about recovery, and recovery is beautiful. And so I was always thinking of doing something different, and I thought, well, maybe I'll change careers. And, you know, and so that's what I'm taking classes now, and we'll see.
Taking classes in what?
I am going for a master's in social work.
Well, good luck with that, and thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, you're welcome.
That's Sylvia Hatzel. She is the mom of James Hatzel, who is now 3 years into his recovery. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott, and our show today is about the mouth. The way your teeth look can be a sign of wealth. Dentistry is expensive. Replacing teeth is really expensive. So having nice, white, straight teeth can be a sign that you're financially doing okay. But there is another way your teeth can show off wealth and status, with grills, gold and precious stone-encrusted adornments for your teeth. This is a very expensive fashion statement that, turns out, has a very long history. The Pulse's Irina Zhuroff has more.
I recently went to a jewelry store in Philadelphia. It's called Shine Jewelers. It's kind of small with immaculately clean display cases and lots of gold and diamonds. I was looking for something specific.
Okay, so here we got a couple of sets of grills.
That's Alex.
My name's Alex Hernandez. I'm the sales representative. I've been here for 10 years.
He takes out a bunch of gold tooth fronts from their envelopes. They're caps you put on your teeth.
This is a plain gold.
Some of them have diamond accents.
Or we could do fully diamond in a pave setting. So something like this, like 4.5 carats, all VS diamond. Get your mouth shining. Something like this goes for about $3,500.
Like a lot of money.
Yeah, jewelry is a precious item, you know?
So what's your sense, like, why do people get them? Like, what do they want out of it?
I think it's just fashion. It's just all about fashion when it comes down to the grills.
Hernandez says he receives 30 to 40 orders per week.
The whole grills phenomenon is just a repetition of Etruscan dental ornamentation.
This is anthropologist Marshall Becker. He's a professor emeritus at Westchester University. He and a scholar at the University of Pennsylvania Museum, Gene Turfa, have been looking at what you could call the first grills in the historic record. Here's Turfa.
They're very simple. It's a thin gold band, about a quarter of a centimeter, half a centimeter wide usually. And in the center of it will be the replacement tooth.
Upper-class Etruscan women who lived about 2,500 years ago in Italy wore them. Usually they'd remove their front teeth, file the roots down, insert them into these gold bands, and the bands would go around other teeth. These women were kind of renegades.
It being Etruscans, their women had a much freer life than any of the surrounding cultures, the Romans, the Greeks. They were horrified at Etruscan women because they literally drove their own chariots and owned factories, used their maiden name. It was an affront to other societies, apparently.
Very few of the Etruscan dental decorations survive, so it's been hard to really tease out their history. But Turfa thinks this was cosmetic, not medical dentistry.
We've looked to ethnographic parallels for some of this, and even today in the world and in the Middle Ages in Asia, people deliberately remove teeth as part of a ritual for coming of age or getting married or for mourning for an important family member or individual.
Other examples of mouth beautification exist too. Maya royalty, about 1,500 years ago, adorned their teeth with jade inlays. Vikings filed their teeth. In Southeast Asia, upper-class people's mouths gleamed with gold some 700 years ago. And all over South and Central America and Central Asia, people still display wealth with gold caps. Grills are just the latest iteration of our human penchant for mouth decor.
When you started seeing grills become popular, what did you think? Were you like, oh, the Etruscans did this so long ago?
Exactly. And I began a little file of grills reports, which I didn't realize would become such a phenomenon at the time. I just thought it was one or two oddballs who thought of something interesting that the Etruscans had done 2,500 years ago.
Yeah, but it's sort of the new aristocracy.
I take all this about the Etruscans back to Alex Hernandez at Shine Jewelers, how the grill goes back more than 2,000 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So, like, who's your clientele mostly?
We deal with a lot of athletes to a lot of celebrities, but from rappers to singers, and to your normal everyday folks.
He says he's done grills for everybody from Meek Mill to Rich the Kid and Shy Glizzy. That's our new grill-wearing aristocracy. For The Pulse, I'm Irina Zhurov.
Rob the jewelry store and tell him make me a grill.
More pedestrian humans, such as myself, also have metal in their mouths, but not to add bling, to fill cavities. Over the decades, dentists have filled teeth with metal blends like amalgam. They've used gold. That's become too expensive, though. And these days, they usually use a white composite filling material. I talked to dentist and researcher Kyle Vining, and he told me those white materials are made up of two main components.
One is what's called a resin. And this is like a plastic material that allows it to be light cured. So that's what you may recall, the blue light that looks kind of orange through the protective light covering.
Mm-hmm.
That light allows the plastic to harden.
Okay.
There's a second main component, which is called a filler. And this makes it really strong and kind of opaque, so it looks white like a tooth. So those are the two main components that go together to make a dental composite.
And what are some new developments that we might see in the next couple of years? Are we 3D printing fillings yet, doing anything cool or exciting?
Definitely. There's a lot of exciting things in dentistry today. One of the main innovations in dentistry is materials. You mentioned 3D printing. There's already, in dental offices, there's already milling of crowns. So dentists can take images, and then a robot can mill the shape of a crown and be placed on the patient's tooth.
When you say milling, what do you mean? Kind of saw it out?
Shaping, yes, exactly. So the dentist can take a picture of the tooth that needs to be restored, and then the computer can look at the image and make a 3D model. And the dentist can use a computer to then design what the crown's going to look like and sends the information to a automated milling machine, which cuts it in three dimensions to fit the shape that'll fit on the tooth.
Okay. Is there anything, you know, I often think how nice it would be if we were like sharks and our teeth could just grow back. Is there anything coming down the pike that might totally revolutionize how we think about dentistry?
Potentially, we're learning a lot about the cells inside teeth and their potential for repair and regeneration. So the teeth is not just what you see on the outside, but also it has the dental pulp, which contains blood vessels, nerves, and cells. And some of these cells, we think, can help regenerate the tooth after injury. So there's a potential in the future where we can use regenerative medicine strategies to try to get the teeth to repair themselves. But this is still a little bit far off.
So if I had a cavity, what would you do?
So a cavity essentially means that the tooth structure is infected. So you need to remove the infected part. But what we want to preserve is the natural healthy tooth that remains inside. And sometimes with dentistry, you may have a filling done and then the tooth becomes very sore afterwards. And that's because the healthy tooth was injured. So really a goal currently in materials is to create biocompatible, meaning materials that don't harm the tissues but can help them repair.
And Kyle, if you could dream up the dentist office of the future, what would that look like for you? What do you hope your field can accomplish?
Well, if I had my choice, I think we don't really understand why certain patients get fillings and need fillings and get decay and others don't. So if we had a way to take a test, that kid came in with a lot of decay, take a sample from their saliva, predict their, you know, what type of bacteria they have that's causing their decay, and maybe give them a vaccine that kills that bacteria so they don't get decay anymore, and really think, how can we fix people permanently? And this is not a new idea. This idea has been around for a long time, but it's really hasn't come to fruition, or is not even close to coming to fruition. But as a dentist, you know, a lot of what we do is surgery. We're fixing disease, but we don't have any treatments that are truly curative, right? So it'd be really impactful in my mind to have ways to completely, you know, cure patients of certain dental diseases like periodontal disease or decay.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
Kyle Vining is a dentist in Brookline, Massachusetts, and he researches the use of dental stem cells at Harvard.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia supports WHYY, providing comprehensive cancer care with treatment options like intraoperative radiation therapy that delivers radiation during surgery to help reduce treatment time and get patients back to their lives faster. At Cancer Treatment Centers of America, they treat every stage of cancer. More at cancercenter.com. Cancer Treatment Centers of America, care that never quits.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott, and you can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Our show today is about the mouth. Now, think for a minute. What's the animal with the scariest mouth on this planet? It's the shark, right? Their mouths are fierce and amazing in so many ways. It's not just their razor-sharp teeth. I talked to Matt Coleman. He is a biologist and researcher at the University of Washington's Friday Harbor Labs, and he told me exactly what makes sharks' mouths so unique.
We have two sets of teeth throughout our lives, and any kid who buys the whole tooth fairy story knows you get just one chance per tooth, and kids have about 20 teeth to get a treat. And then when we lose those teeth and we regain our adult set, we have around 30 teeth. But sharks would be rolling in dough if there was a tooth fairy, because they go through hundreds, probably thousands of teeth throughout their lives, because they need those teeth that are razor sharp. And as soon as these teeth dull, they are replaced by newer, sharper teeth that are sort of lying in reserve.
So they just grow back like fingernails?
Yeah, so we kind of call them, we sort of call it a conveyor belt. So if you ever look at shark jaws, right behind the sort of main set of teeth are usually, you know, 10 to 20 rows of fully formed teeth that are just like awaiting to sort of flip up.
But where do they store all these extra teeth? Like, I'm thinking about my own face. So if I had thousands of teeth, where would I put them?
Yeah, so they're stored sort of in the actual jaw. So as the teeth wear, they're sort of lost through the front of the jaw. And then right behind that tooth is a new tooth that starts to act as, you know, the newest tooth.
That's cool. I want that.
Yeah, it would be nice. You know, we wouldn't have to go to like the dentist.
What else can sharks' jaws do that I can't?
So it's not just the teeth that make shark jaws weird. So if we think about our skull, we have one sort of movable part, you know, the lower jaw, the mandible, and moves up and down and moves slightly from right to the left as we chew. But the upper jaw in sharks is not fused to the skull. It hangs down and it's supported by other skeletal parts. And while either side of your jaw is fused at the chin, sharks have a joint there, which allows them to sort of flex the jaws at that point. And so this makes shark jaws very dynamic, very flexible. They have these joints that we don't have. Our jaws are mostly fused and move in only one or two directions. But on the other end of the spectrum lie creatures like sharks and stingrays and other vertebrates like snakes. And not only do these jaws flex, the whole skull can move, allowing sharks to sort of sling their jaws and mouth forward away from their head to engulf prey.
And Matt, what's the weirdest thing you've ever come across a shark eating or doing?
The weirdest thing, I do remember being on a boat, and we were long lining for sharks, and we had a tiger shark show up on deck, and almost immediately it got up on deck and just vomited basically seabird feet all over the deck. Because they're one of the few sharks that's really known to eat birds. And so that was pretty gross, because really all we saw was just the bills, the feathers, and then the feet, which was nuts. Yeah.
So I guess the feet didn't sit well. Matt Coleman is a biologist and researcher at the University of Washington. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott, and we've been talking about mouths on today's show. And we started the hour by discussing just how important the mouth is to so many aspects of our basic functioning. For example, eating and drinking. Like most of us, Steven Stelzer used to take that ability to chew and to swallow food for granted, until a strange medical condition changed his life dramatically. His son, Andrew Stelzer, is a regular contributor to our show, and he has this story.
Hello?
Hey, Dad. Hello, Dad.
When I tell people about my dad's situation, there's usually two main points that really get their attention. First, a low point, and then a high point, and then comes a whole bunch of questions. So first things first, my dad is not able to swallow correctly. And what I mean by that is that instead of going into his stomach, some of the food or liquid he swallows goes into his lungs, and he kept getting pneumonia from that. And as a result, he hasn't eaten or drank anything in over 2 years. Anything.
Do you remember the last meal you ate?
Well, I don't know. I don't remember. I mean, I love chicken. Maybe it was chicken. I don't know. People ask me, what do I want? And I tell them, the most things I want is a cold glass of water.
Water.
I see people drinking cold water, a bottle of cold water. That really hits me.
So that's the bad part. And if you're like most people, you're probably picturing my dad in a hospital bed, shriveled up, near death, with tubes running in and out of his body. So now comes the good part.
I went to the gym early this morning. I went on the elliptical machine for an hour. Then I came back and I saw a friend. And then I went to therapy.
Yes, you heard that right. My dad goes to the gym, hangs out with his friends, takes the subway around town, but he still can't eat or drink anything. And there's a good chance he will never eat or drink again. One of the most frustrating parts is there's been no diagnosis at all. He was tested for everything from ALS, MS, to Parkinson's. All the results were negative. So how can someone live without eating or drinking? My dad has a feeding tube inserted into his stomach. It requires a lot of maintenance, which my stepmom helps out with.
Okay, stand up, honey.
Let me get the tape.
Scissors.
And the scissors.
Oh, and the cream.
Keeping that hole in his stomach healthy is really important. At this point, the hole is basically my dad's second mouth, so to speak.
We gotta do this, I guess.
Oh, looks what? Red.
What?
It's
this?
Red
here?
And it's not clean.
Here.
Yeah.
Well, we did this yesterday.
Well, Dr. Weber has to see it.
Every day, my dad uses what looks like a giant syringe to feed himself. And that word is in quotation marks. He feeds himself this white, gooey, nutritional supplement called Tucal. It takes 4 or 5 cans a day to give his body enough calories.
I guess you don't feel like you're eating, but do you feel like you're even feeding yourself? Or is it like you're just feeding the tube?
Feeding the tube. Feeding the tube. It's not feeding me.
When's the last time you've been hungry?
Probably just before I found out that I couldn't eat or drink. I don't know. A couple of years ago.
Watching him has made me realize how not being able to use a part of your body often means you have to pay a lot more attention to it. Like if you break your arm, you really have to take care of that arm in a way you never did before. For my dad, it's kind of like his mouth is sort of broken. So now a lot of his daily routine revolves around his mouth. He can't use water to brush his teeth. He has to go to the dentist more often because bacteria could end up in his lungs. He even has to take medicine to keep his mouth from generating too much saliva. That saliva could end up in his lungs.
My relationship to my mouth is that I took it for granted, and now it's a huge part of my life. My wife, Francie, and I do not go out for meals anymore. We used to. So I guess we save money on that. You know, people have worse things than this. You know, they have cancer and major heart disease, right?
That's true.
So everyone has something.
I understand what my dad is saying, and really, I'm in awe of how good an attitude he has about his situation, but I'm still trying to find an answer.
So has this changed your view of the medicine industrial complex or of mainstream medicine?
Absolutely, it has changed it. I was very naive. I grew up thinking that doctors were magicians and, you know, they had answers to everything. And I was angry. I said, what do you mean you can't figure it out? You're a doctor. I mean, how can I have this condition? And no one knows its cause. No one can even name it. I mean, it's primal. It's your mouth. You're born crying.
While I'm still hopeful that my dad will figure this out and we can go out to dinner for barbecued chicken someday, he's pretty much given up. And ironically, he's happier than he's been in years. It's sort of hard to imagine. It seems like such a miserable situation he's in. But I guess sometimes losing hope is a way to free yourself and find happiness in what you still have.
All right, so we'll Skype tomorrow, probably.
Okay, I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Okay, bye. Take care. Bye.
That was Andrew Stelzer telling us about his dad, Steven Stelzer. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Irina Zhorov. Alex Stern is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager, our associate producer. Joel Patterson, the managing editor. And Megan Pinto, our executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Next time on The Pulse, the view from space is breathtaking.
To fly over, you know, the Great Barrier Reef, to be outside on a spacewalk and fly through an aurora, these are things that, you know, just are deeply etched in my mind.
Seeing the Earth from far away tends to change people.
This is a view that inspires you to do good and to cooperate.
Astronauts, awe, and what it means for the rest of us. Don't miss that episode of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.